I'm Ian Danter. This is The Commentator's Curse. This is the show where we kind of lift the lid on the weird world that us commentators inhabit. I've been commentating on football for local and national radio for over two decades now. And in every press box I go to, I meet some wonderful people who've had a very different journey to my weird journey to get to where they are. And that's kind of what this podcast is all about, finding out about the journeys that people take. And it's a bit of a Northeast special today. I'll get to that in a moment, but I must remind you that there are 11 episodes already out in The Commentator's Curse. We have an archive of episodes you can dip into where you found this podcast. And if you're listening via Apple, there's always the rate, review, and subscribe. It's always there for you, as Graham Taylor would say. So you can, you know, put a nice review on there and tell me how much you enjoy the show, if you do. So moving swiftly on, we start episode 12. And as I mentioned, it's a Northeast special. It's a Tyne Wear clash of two gentlemen who became synonymous with the clubs they commentated on for quite some time. My first guest is a man who spent a quarter of a century watching Newcastle United, both for the BBC and for independent local radio too, but predominantly for BBC Radio Newcastle. He has now retired. He's put down the mic and he's enjoying retirement, but Newcastle keeps trundling on doing mad things, even though he's put the mic down. Mick Lowes is with us on The Commentator's Curse. Hello, Mick.
Hi, Ian. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you too. Nice to have you on the show. And from the other side of the Northeast, from Tyneside to Wearside, a gentleman who I got to know when he was working for ILR in the Northeast as Sunderland's commentator. But Metro Radio was where Crabb has made his name as Sunderland's commentator. He hasn't retired. He's not really doing commentary anymore. He has a very different role within the sphere of Premier League productions. But we'll get to that as we go. Simon Crabtree's with us on The Commentator's Curse. Crabbers, how are you?
Hello, very good. Thank you for inviting me. It's lovely to see not so much you, but certainly Mr. Lowes. It's been too long.
It has, and vice versa. And vice versa, young Crabtree. Not so much young Crabtree.
Got a round of applause there, Crabbers. That was proper hands across.
But, yeah, well, absolutely.
Time tease.
And now I thought, oh, I didn't. It's too late now. Spoilt it for everyone.
Yeah, we can't go back now. The cat's out of the bag.
It's done.
Gentlemen, the way things are, Graham Courtney, my colleague on TalkSport and a chap you both know very well, once said to me, well, it's kind of his mantra, never a dull moment in the Northeast. And even though your connections are no longer with the Northeast as commentators or as people within the industry, the madness in the Northeast, Mick, just keeps on trundling along. If you were on air right now with all this shenanigans with Newcastle, how do you think you'd be approaching it?
Well, in the same way that I think I approached every one of the 365 days of the 25 years I was there, wondering where the circus was, when the circus was coming to town, when the circus was leaving town, when we were going to get some sort of resolution to whatever problem or whatever story was on the go at the time. It is, as Simon will tell you, and as most people know, I think genuinely, it is, you know, you can call it a cliched hotbed, you can call it whatever. But it is an area which seems to be synonymous with stories, and it's born out of really just a huge appetite for football. You know, the reason there are so many stories, the reason there are so many controversies, whatever, is because there's an appetite for it. So, you know, it's in the interests of particularly newspapers and broadcasters to hype it up a little bit, because it gets you listeners, it gets you readers. So on top of the fact that, I mean, particularly Newcastle, but, you know, Sunderland have been through the mill, ups and downs, for the best part of the last quarter of a decade as well. So I think it's just the nature of the beast, Dancer. But I think I just think it is as much as anything, born out of that huge appetite for football from the people of the Northeast, probably more so than anywhere else I've ever worked, certainly.
And Crabbers, even though you have left the Northeast as a commentator, you must look at the Sunderland Till I Die documentary, the current situation, a fourth season in League One. And you must scratch your head based on the Sunderland you were commentating on, you know, the Peter Reid era and the success of Quinn and Phillips and whatnot. It's a It's a strange old time on Wearside.
It is. I'm sure Mick will probably agree as well. You sort of saw it coming to a certain degree at Sunderland. You just saw the slow decline, sadly, once Quinny's Drummerville consortium. Just things weren't quite right, I think, after that. And it was probably like a bit like falling downstairs. You know it's going to hurt. You hope that the stairs are going to end. I think they have at Sunderland. It does feel as though they are reorganising, galvanising, but they have to get out of League One. And until they do, it doesn't feel as though it's properly on the up again. But it is very, very different than when me and Mick used to be commentating on games at the very top of the Premier League.
Let's go back to the start, if I may, gentlemen, because that... One thing that this podcast is all about is kind of sliding doors moments and ambitions and aspirations. Mick, if I come to you first, when you were at school, was there a particular desire to get into broadcast journalism, or did something fall into your lap, as it were?
I don't really know, Ian. I've been thinking about this, obviously, in the days since I've been waiting to do it. And I think in some ways it would be wrong of me to say, no, not really, because... I was absolutely football obsessed. From my very first memories. I mean, my mother always says to me, you learnt to read through football. You learnt to read through reading football reports and reading football books and putting the words in the right order and recognising words because they were football orientated. And I think it's absolutely true. And then when you're at junior school, I can vividly remember when on a Monday morning, kids were told to write a story about their weekend involvement in parties or whatever. I regurgitated a Chelsea 4, Leeds United 3 match report from Match of the Day and put the goal scorers' names in block capitals in the middle of the report, an 89th minute equalisers and things like that. So I was doing it then. But if you ask me, did I genuinely set out to become a commentator, I'd have to say no, because, having listened to a few of these and over the years, I've got to know a million football commentators. And there are those who sat in front of the telly mocking up commentaries. There are those who got their little Tandy cassette recorders and recorded stuff that they sent out to radio stations or sent out to anybody who was prepared to listen. I did none of that. Absolutely none of that. I never did a post-grad. I went to college at 18. I went to Polytechnic in London. But I went to Polytechnic in London at 18 just to get away from Nottingham, just to get away from my parents and have 3 years listening to punk rock in London. I had no... It was never a means to an end. It was a way to get out of the house and have a good time in London for 3 years from 79 to 82. When I came back, I just happened to bump into a guy who, funnily enough, I saw on Friday, a guy who I went to junior school with and secondary school with, Andrew James, who lived two doors down from Brian Tansley, who was the presenter of Radio Trent's Saturday afternoon sports programme. He'd got a job initially being a runner, basically just feeding the scores in from upstairs and taking them downstairs to the studio, Chelsea 2, Everton 1, Scunthorpe 3, Crewe 0, had managed to get himself a little number doing Mansfield Town and had become very proficient at it. And I bumped into him on the 24 bus and he said, "What do you want to do?" I said, "Well, I've been away at Poly. I was still playing football." And intertwined with that, I'd done match reports for Middlesex Poly's weekly paper on football matches that I'd been involved in just for the hell of it. And I said, "Well, I wouldn't mind a little bash at what you're doing." A week later, he introduced me to Brian Tansley. I went into Trent. He put me in the old soundproof booth, asked me to read that afternoon's Rip and Read, and then offered me on the spot. They didn't have anything else but Nottingham Rugby Club. He said, "I'll give you a fiver to cover Nottingham Rugby Club for us." So I spent 4 years working for the county council because my dad was involved in social services. And he got me sort of a 6 month gig at the library, a 6 month gig as postboy at County Hall. I had all these temporary contracts for years and years. And then on a Saturday did the rugby and then had to make the decision in 87 to say, right, do I want to do this properly? Do I want to do this seriously? But I'd done nothing other than match reports on a Saturday afternoon. I think I'd done one bulletin on Trent reading the sports news and doing the sports magazine program on a Friday night. But that was the sum total of my experience. And as Crabbers knows, and as everybody on this program knows, I was in that situation where, how do you get experience if you haven't got a proper job? How do you get experience without getting experience? So I took the plunge. To cut a long story short, the one thing that occurred in around about that time was the advent of the 0898 phone services and Supercall, which was an arm of BT, which launched the club call service, were looking for full-time journalists in London. And I applied for a job there and I said, right, I'm going there. So I'd got myself into London. I'd got myself working full-time in the media, and it went from there. But as everybody says on this program, it's more about who you know rather than what you know initially anyway.
Well, club call is something for a previous generation to have lapsed.
Yeah.
But those in their 20s and maybe even 30s listening to this would go, what the dickens? But it was the...
But club call at the time, Ian, was the social media of the 1980s. Because what it did was, it wasn't mainstream media. Because I've also heard people on here say, you know, it's a crying shame with the fact that independent radio no longer does TV. Kids nowadays don't get opportunities. It's nonsense. There are so many media jobs out there these days. There's so many, you know, online media, social media, you know, multimedia, bi media, this media, that media. Back in the day, the only media was a newspaper, a television, or a radio. And there weren't that many jobs in any of those three if you were 18, 19, 20, 21 years of age. So all of a sudden, telephone services, which were proper, by the way, you got to deal with managers. You got to deal with... I went out, I remember, I think my first game was West Ham against somebody at Upton Park. I was sat in the equivalent of a Division One press box for the first time in my life at 26, working for a telephone company. It was going out into the ether. I had no idea where it was going. It wasn't radio, but it was the first step on the ladder to doing it properly.
Amazing stuff. You're right. You're right. There was a very barren landscape in terms of jobs in those days. Crabbers, I know you're from a slightly... You came into radio slightly later in terms of a timeline than Mick did, but did you not have a grounding in print journalism before you got into broadcasting?
He's saying you're old there, Mick, isn't he?
I'll take it, mate. I am old.
Yeah, I mean, like Mick, in terms of starting, never set out to want to be a commentator at the very beginning. It was sort of, a lot of it I fell into. As you both know, I quite like talking to people, listening to people. I'd like to say listening to people more than talking to people. My first ever interview was with the bin man. My mum had come down one morning, couldn't find me. And like Mick says, with a little, it might have been Binatones with a cassette, wasn't it? Whatever it was, I had a little recording thing and went out. I was interviewing the bin man. I think I must have been 7 or 8 years old, maybe. That was my first ever interview. I made little newspapers. I wanted to be a reporter more than anything. Brian Ellis at the Lancashire Evening Post let me come in every now and then and do bits and pieces for him. That led to me working at a press agency doing, Blackpool for the... Crikey, who did I have? I had the Sunday Post copy that I had to ring up and do those. The People, the Sunday Mirror, I had to do the Marks Out of 10 for Shoot and Match. That then led to me meeting someone at Radio Lancashire who said they were looking for someone on the weekends. I went off to study for my journalism qualifications up in the Northeast and was sort of going backwards and forwards. Did a bit at Club Call, doing sort of Hartlepool and Darlington stuff and things like that. And then it's just like Nick says, it's then who you meet, who you talk to, you find out about the opportunities. And if you're hungry enough and if you want it enough, then, you know, you take a chance and you go for it. And like Mick, worked at TFM. That was my first. I worked at Ray Lancashire for a good while, but that was more tech hopping for a while, producing for a while. Gary Hickson, who I spoke to last weekend, used to send me out on non-league games and doing bits and pieces like that. And just learning to say yes, like still now today, trying to say yes to as much as possible, because you never know what that yes is going to lead to. And eventually, like I say, via Middlesbrough at TFM, caught up with Mick, who very, very kindly took a chance on me at Metro Radio.
I'll get to that in a minute, but I must, once you mentioned filing copy there, I love the idea that, you know, you get a, you're filing copy down a telephone to somebody back at, you know, based back at the newspaper. There must have been times when what you said was not printed the way you'd said it. You know, that errors were made back at base to make you look a bit daft.
Do you know what? I think it was quite, well, I mean, it was, there were match reports at a sort of much lower level. So it might have only been 100 words, 250 tops, that sort of thing. But I used to love phoning the Sunday. I always look forward to the Sunday Post. So the Sunday Post, I'm sure people do know listening, but a Scottish-centric paper, but living where I do in the Northwest, you know, big Scottish contingent that live around here. And it's still in most of the news agents now. So Earl Woolley and the Bruins people will probably remember sitting on the bucket and what have you. But ringing up and just all the... There were always women on the other end of the copy tech, and they always sounded like the most beautiful woman that you've ever spoke to. It's always, hello, Shandy Post copy. Hello, it's Simon at Deepdale. I've got a match report for you. Press the North End against Darlington. Okay, Simon, off you go. And they would touch type at the other end. It was like, cap P, cap N, cap E, Preston North End, and then off you'd go. And then it was learning. So if you said a player's name, the first time you said his name, you said his full name. So it would be first time you said it, it would Mick Lowe's. And then every time after that, it was just Lowe's. And it was learning all the little nuances. But it was so exciting as well, because literally on the final whistle, I had to phone Sunday Post, Mail on Sunday, Sunday Mirror, Sunday People, whoever it might be. And then the marks out of 10 that you'd have to do it at the time, they were quite important. Certainly the match and the shoot ones, people would sort of look up them as well. And there was a player, I'll not name his name, but a lot of my friends are Blackpool fans. And he once, they were at some away game, and he turned round and told them to play, well, not too politely, to go to a place that rhymes with luck and stay there. So for the next 3 months, the most he would ever get out of 10 would be 5 if I was ever doing the match reports. Really and simply on that. But really good. I mean, in terms of the newspapers, I always found that having a sense of what a good story was, having started in newspapers, with local radio and even national radio to a certain degree, it's a very different beast in terms of what's a story and what's not a story. But really good grounding. And as well, trying to get things quickly. What's a story? Get it quickly, send it. And that's why radio is perfect, because it's immediate.
That must have been the very early days of marking players out of 10, doing that. That must have been a fairly novel thing, because I don't remember that being around.
Mick, you're the old person in this group.
When I was doing the rugby, so the rugby was my first sort of inkling and first outing into journalism, because I got quite good, and Nottingham got quite good high profile. So suddenly they went from a very bog standard team. Suddenly they acquired Rob Andrew, they had Gary Reese, they had Brian Moore. So then I got a call from Orton's press agency in Leicester, and same as Crabbers. So you get a call on the Friday night saying, can you do 150 words for the Daily Express? Can you do 50 words for so-and-so? But I must admit that that merit marks never came into it. I suspect because it was rugby, and that would have been 30 merit marks plus the subs. So maybe. But just touching on there about the telephone system, here's an interesting one that I don't think I've heard mentioned on here, because I've listened to most of the episodes, about taking the pips off, right? So if you were doing radio back in the day, and all the reports were done on telephones, and especially if you're doing rugby, because rugby grounds, with the exception of, I think, maybe Leicester, Gloucester, they didn't have stadiums. They had like a stand with one phone in it and about half a dozen people, and everybody else was in the bar getting pissed, and everybody else was around the pitch, you know? So you had that one phone. So that one phone, you had to ring back from Pontypool or Neath or Blackheath or Gosforth in the northeast, and you had to pick up the phone and you had to say, could I have a reverse charge call to Nottingham, please? And they say, yes, what's the number? You give them the number, and then very quickly you had to say, could you take the pips off, please? It's for a broadcast, which meant that when it connected or halfway through the call, in order that you weren't going to put another 10p in, you didn't get a beep, 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 beep like you used to do.
Yeah.
So the early rollickings I got weren't for the standard of my broadcasting or the fact that I got the facts wrong or the fact that I got the score wrong. I forgot to take the effing beeps off. I forgot to tell the operator to take the beeps off. So I'd be in full flow. You know, I'd be a fledgling reporter, but I'd be giving it big licks. And Reese gave it to Moore, and on the overlap, Hartley went to go over in the corner for the match-winning try, and all of a sudden, beep, 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 beep. So the beeps were the bane of my life if I ever forgot to take the bips off.
There you go, folks. Never forget, take the pips off and you're golden.
Gladys Knight never did, and she did all right.
I was told a great story about Gladys Knight. She was singing the national anthem at an NFL game or something. And, you know, you have those wonderful baritone American announcers, don't you, at sports. Ladies and gentlemen.
Let's singing, get ready to rumble.
Singing our national anthem, Miss Gladys Knight. And suddenly from somewhere in the arena, somebody shouted, Gladys Knight sucks. And there was this pregnant pause, and the announcer barks down the mic, nevertheless, here he is. We talk about sliding doors moments a lot on this podcast. Yeah. And when did the sliding doors moment, because I presume London led to Newcastle, did it, or not?
Do you know what it is? I mean, I think I've probably only heard this sliding doors phrase since I've been listening to this, although I do know a lot of people who use sliding doors. I mean, I've never really sort of got a handle on it, sliding doors. Mm-hmm. Basically, I'm a lucky so-and-so. But if one thing leads to another, I mean, it's been incredible. I'll give you a précis of how ridiculous it is. I'm in Nottingham. I'm working for the county council. I'm doing Nottingham Rugby Club on a Saturday for a fiver, by the way, for a fiver up and down the country. People will know how much beer I can drink. I mean, there were some weekends I got back on the team bus. I owed them about 15 quid, you know. So, you know, a fiver. But going back to what Crabber said in a roundabout way earlier, it's the effort and the lengths you go to prove yourself. The things you do. You don't care if you're out of pocket. You don't care if you're down on your bended knees begging people for an interview. You don't care if it's freezing cold in the middle of nowhere doing Nottingham Rugby Club against Redruth. You don't care. You want to get through that day. You want to put another notch on the bedpost and go again and go again. So I'm doing Nottingham Rugby Club, who, you know, again, I don't know what this is. I don't know what it is. It's luck. It's luck. So suddenly they become good. So Nottingham Rugby Club, who were ranked bad, suddenly get Rob Andrews, suddenly get Richard Moon, suddenly get Chris Oatey, suddenly get my mate Simon Hodgkinson, England fullback, suddenly get Gary Rees, England flanker, suddenly get Brian Moore, England hooker. You know, their profile rises, my profile rises. I'm getting gigs at the local newspaper. I'm getting gigs at Orton's press agency in Leicester. I then decide to take the jump. I go to Supercall in London. I've been at Supercall, where I've gone from a reporter to deputy sports editor within 6 months. It's going well. But all of a sudden, unbeknown to me, a guy there, Richard Coghill, I'll mention all these names because I need to mention these names. Richard Coghill knows Jonathan Pearce. Jonathan Pearce says, I know I need a vacancy. I need somebody reliable at Capital Radio, the biggest radio station in Europe. Richard Coghill says he's a kid at Supercall who's not bad. I meet Pearce. Pearce and me say, right, he says you can do the Sunday morning shift. So I'm up at 6 o'clock in the morning. I'm buying the papers outside Warren Street Tube. I'm into Capital. All I'm doing is a 2-minute read on a Sunday morning. Suddenly, 6 months later, they launch Capital Gold Sport. Me and Pearce front up Capital Gold Sport. We do the World Cup in 1990. We win the Sony Gold Award in 1990. 91, I'm number two. I decide I need to leave. I go to the BBC in Newcastle in 1991 as sports editor. But all of that is chance. The fact that Capital launched Capital Gold. The fact that, you know, Nottingham Rugby Club got good. The fact that, you know, Jonathan took a chance on me. And this is why, when Crabbers kindly says, Mick took a chance on me. If somebody's taken a chance on you, you take a chance on them. You pass the baton on. You don't ever, ever think, I'm going to keep that to myself, or I'm going to keep it for a mate. You keep it for somebody who is good enough. Because if you don't, if you're nepotistic and you pass it on to somebody for the sake of passing it on to your mate, not only will they get found out, you'll get found out because you recommended them in the first place. So, you know, to cut a long story short, that's the way it went. But an incredible journey. And just to give you an idea of how incredible it was, I was still doing Nottingham Rugby Club and had never done a commentary in my life until 87. I went to Supercore, still hadn't done a proper commentary. I was doing the World Cup finals in Italy 2 years later in 1990. Crazy, because Pierce and Richard Park at Capital took a chance on me. So it's, I don't know if that's sliding doors. I just prefer to think of it as being a lucky fucker.
I think you're probably right. Sliding doors is a phrase that gets used a lot, but I think it's when you get the lucky break and then the hard work begins.
That's true to a degree, Dan. But I'll remind me to tell you a story in a little bit. Yes, there is luck. Yes, there are sliding doors. But the bottom line is, don't ever think that you got to where you got to because of luck. Don't ever think you got there because you were fortunate. You got there because you worked hard and you worked incredibly hard and you worked selflessly and you worked long hours and your father finished a day's work and drove back and picked you up and took you with a ewer to Nottingham Rugby Club and sat in a car park for 3 hours because I'd missed the interview and he didn't get home till 11 at night. People make sacrifices. So don't think you're lucky. The sacrifices we made got us to where we got to.
Very good point, Mick. I must bring this up at this point. We'll get to... I'll come back to JP and Capital Gold and World Cup finals in a minute, Mick. But Simon, you mentioned how Mick gave you that leg up with Metro Radio. So what year was this when Mick took a chance on you?
99, 2000, I think. So, yeah. Guy Mowbray had been the commentator of Sunderland matches. Guy Gillian Gatesy, which is still talked about very fondly in the Northeast now. Did Guy go to ITV from Metro?
He did, yeah. He was literally only there a year.
Was he only there a year?
Well, the digital collapse happened, wasn't it? That's what happened.
Yeah, I think he might have gone to ITV. But having prior to that, he'd done the 98 World Cup in France for Eurosport and then had taken a mainstream gig at Metro, but was gone within a year or so.
I think he was there longer than that. I know that the Eurosport one, I think at the time, was he not the youngest English-speaking commentator ever on the World Cup final or something like that? Did he go to Paris and sit in a broom cupboard or similar and do his commentaries?
Yeah. With a croissant,
So with a croissant. And lovely croissant it was as well. It's an empty pasty, a croissant, really, isn't it? My radio journey started at TFM.
Right.
I got offered a job. It was horrific. It was something like $7,500 a year. And that would have been 1996, 97, maybe. And it was basically starting at 5 o'clock until, I think, 10 o'clock, doing the breakfast sport and helping with the traffic and travel and occasionally reading the news. And then coming back in again at 3:30 until 6:30. And again, traffic and travel and writing the news for that one. And then...
Sweeping the carpets.
And cleaning the carpets, washing the windows, whatever else. I remember turning up on the first morning at that time on Teesside and then ringing 999 because it looked like there was a massive fire out the window. So like, nine, I said, fire, please. Yeah, what is it? I said, there's a huge fire. Have you just moved up to Middlesbrough, have you, son? Yes, I have. Yeah, that's the industrial plants there. That's going to be like that every morning that you go to work.
Oh, brilliant.
Really sorry. So from TFM, a while at Alpha in Darlington, which I loved, and then Sun FM in Sunderland, which was great fun as well.
Yeah.
And then in the meantime, Andrew Dolby, I think, took over from Guy. Dolbers moved off just as quickly. And then very luckily, I remember exactly where I was in a pub in Fitzgerald's in Sunderland, enjoying a pint of some terrible bitter. I can't remember the name of it now.
Vaux.
No, Vaux was a good beer, actually.
Oh, was it?
But Mick said, did Guy mention you to me? Or I can't remember who'd mentioned it, but for whatever reason...
I can't remember who it was. It was somebody, obviously. I might have heard you myself. I don't know. I just remember there was something about you that I thought, yeah. I don't think I was necessarily told. I don't know. It's a bit like Jim Proudfoot. Jim Proudfoot was at TFM, and I phoned Pierce and said, look, because Pierce said to me, I need somebody. I said, give him a chance. Yeah.
So Mick found me and said, come in for a chat. Went in for a chat. And I don't even... That was it. Pretty much it, wasn't it? We clicked from the off, fortunately for me. And Mick said, when can you start? So I handed him a month's notice. I'd never done a single commentary before then. He went... And then, so everything I learned from then was thanks to Mick, really. So even down to the notes, if I ever, well, through all the years I did the commentary, and if I'm ever lucky enough to do them as a fill-in for anyone, mine mirror, because Mick sometimes puts his commentary notes on Instagram and things like that. Mm-hmm. Mick just said, this is how I do it. So that's what I did. That's what Mick did. And then Mick would give me little tips and hints and things. I remember being at a game at Spurs when we did the phone, and I used to hate those phone-ins. And I pretty much, I didn't lose the plot, but I got hooked in by a caller. And then on the Monday morning, sat down with Mick and said, you know, I understand why it happened, but instead of doing that, do this. And so all the little things, the way of nuances of the way you spoke, the way you commentated, the way you dealt with people, the way you went into press conference, I've got that lovely gentleman there to thank for an awful lot of all the good things that happened in my career, because A, like I say, he did take a chance on me, and B, he then guided me through the highs and lows that we sort of had together. And a lot of people just stick you in and say, off you crack. And then, Mick went, you know, he did what good people do in terms of, you know, guided me and got rid of not all the rubbish, but I've still got quite a lot of that in my locker, but he did help me so much.
But, you know, I don't think that happens anymore, do you? I don't know whether you two agree, but, you know, I had a lad phone me up about a month ago, maybe, and I loved it because he phoned me and he said, I did a work experience at Newcastle a few years ago, and I'm now a commentator. I won't say where he's a commentator. And I'm just at a bit of a wall, you know? Could you give me a hand? They don't ask nowadays. People don't ask, and people don't help each other nowadays. You know, I just think people say, oh, okay, you know, well, you know, get on with it, sink or swim. And I don't know whether they take some sort of perverse pleasure from people failing. You know, I don't know what it is. I think we are a very different breed to the ones we were. I mean, in my case, we're talking about a lot of years ago. But even, you know, even when Crabbers, you know, started, I mean, you are talking 20 years ago now. So, I just think we are a different breed. I think we need to help one another. But maybe it's because, as in life in general, there's so much diversification. There's so much. Everybody wants everything yesterday. Everything wants everything spontaneously, and then they're not prepared to wait. So if you know, it's sink or swim sort of thing. I don't know.
Trust me, Mick. If somebody asked me, I'd happily proffer advice.
Absolutely.
I've never been asked. I was saying on last week's episode, I asked Sam Matterface, my talks colleague, to give me notes on a commentary I recently did, because I knew he'd be driving home having done the commentary before mine. So I would have him as a captive listener in his car so he could give me critique on what I'd done. But that's not something you do regularly. It's just something periodically, just to, you know, keep your standards to where you want them to be, Crabbers.
Yeah. I mean, because of what Mick did for me, I'm sometimes proactive. If I've heard somebody and I think they've done it well, I'll get in touch with them. Because I think that's nice sometimes as well, for people just to be reminded actually what they're doing is great.
Yeah.
I messaged someone I'd heard her do a podcast this week that I really enjoyed. So I told her I really enjoyed it. And that's enough and it doesn't happen. And there's sometimes, like, again, because of what Mick did to me, if I hear a reporter doing something, I'll ring up and I'll go, you know, that was good, but try doing X, Y, or Z. And Like Mick says, it's not just in our industry. It just feels there's a lot of time now that's in the world, sadly, where people maybe don't do that. Now, that is possibly us becoming the older person who always says the younger person isn't. But
I think people look after number one too much these days, don't they? You know, you don't have neighbours in the way you used to have neighbours. Do you know what I mean? So everybody looks after number one, and it's a very selfish world in many ways. I don't know. It's maybe getting a bit too philosophical about it. I don't know.
Well, Mick, when we think back to Capital Gold, when you went into work with Jonathan Pierce in the late 80s into the early 90s. Now, Capital Gold was a very, and I worked there, you know, 10 years hence.
Yeah.
And I worked for Tom up in the Midlands. Mm. But it's a very tough working environment. It was sink or swim. You had to learn quickly. But as much as you were Crabber's mentor, it's clear that JP was a massive mentor to you and helped to guide you through for that short period of time before Newcastle came calling.
Oh, absolutely. 100%. 100%. And I spent years, you know, I don't know whether he'll listen to this. I think he probably knows it anyway. But, you know, I just remember when Jonathan went from sort of Capital and everybody wanted a piece of him and the Channel 5 commentaries and this, that and the other. And he completely changed the landscape of commentary as well as sports broadcasting in many ways because of that style, because of that, you know, machine gun style, very loud, very... you know, very fan based. That's all it was. You know, you were basically talking as a fan, but you were doing it in a very, you know, provocative way in many ways. And it didn't suit Telly. And I used to say to him, you know, I really don't think it fits Telly. But he was doing what his masters employed him to do. But the one thing that used to really appall me, and I had argument after argument after argument wherever I went. Oh, Jonathan Pierce, he knows nothing. Absolute nonsense. The fellow was like me. You know, he was brought up with football. He knew football inside out. Encyclopedic knowledge of football. And on top of that was a fantastic operator. So, you can say what you like about the way that you commentate. You can say what you like about the way people broadcast. But if you suggest that they don't know what they're talking about, if you suggest they don't know their subject matter, then that's when I used to get really angry. You know, I never had a problem with people saying, oh, that Mick Lowe's, you know, he's good on this, he's good on that. I just don't like the way that he talked. I don't like his voice. I can cope with that. I think JP, you know, could cope with that as well, you know.
Yeah.
It was, you know, the style was a bit scattergun. But the thing that always makes me laugh is that when we first started it at Capital, because, you know, we were the first, and I'm not saying we, it's not a royal we, because it was Jonathan's idea and that's the way we did it. But everybody else went, particularly the BBC. Here come the loud people. Here come the shouters into the press box. Believe me, 3, 4, 5 years later, they were all doing it the same, and they weren't doing it as well either. You know, they were shouting for shouting's sake. They were being provocative for provocative sake. You have to be able to carry it off. And he could carry it off. And as I say, I'd had no real mainstream radio experience. So I was absolutely blessed to be in the company of somebody who, A, was forward thinking, but B, had such a good grounding. I mean, we're only a couple of years apart. So it's not as if he was my mentor in terms of 10 years. But we just hit it off, you know, and a bit like Simon. I mean, I was thinking to myself when I knew Crabbers was on today. I think, you know, when you talk about people in life and how well you get on with people in life, in all the years I've known Jonathan, I don't think I've ever had a crossword. Ian Dennis, I've never had a crossword with Denno. Crabbers, I don't think I've ever had a crossword with Dennis. And believe me, I can have a crossword. I could have a crossword with Mother Teresa if the circumstances dictated. I can be a pretty agitated sort of person. But honestly, he and I, you know, in the same way that Simon and I hit it off, he and I hit it off big style. And we hit it off big style. And that 3 or 4 years maybe at Capital were absolutely golden years, because that radio station at the time was going through its greatest ever period. We were getting New York awards. We won the Sony Award in 1990. You know, it was a fabulous, fabulous time. You are so lucky to be part of it.
Well, yes. I mean, Birmingham felt the, you know, it was kind of by osmosis, kind of that ethos.
Yeah.
Because of Richard Park being the kind of overlord of the whole thing.
Yeah.
That ethos bled through to what was happening with the Capital Gold in Birmingham, and indeed with the other places around the country where, you know, Capital had its umbrella, yeah, where it had its influence. Anybody who's never heard Jonathan Pearce's radio commentary, I'm sure you'll be able to find it. One classic example is the Eric Cantona Kung Fu kick at Selhurst Park. You'll have seen the pictures on television. You remember Des Lynam being all quite solemn for a change on Sports Night before he introduced the highlights. But Pearce's commentary on that moment, it's spine tingling. It's not even a goal. It's just a French international launching a karate kick at a disgruntled supporter. But it's unbelievable commentary. And he reached, Mariah Carey couldn't hit those notes. If you really, it's a, just anybody, just try and find it. It's well worth it. Kramers, what was your first commentary then? Once Mick had took you under his wing, what was your first?
Full match commentary on Metro Radio was Sunderland 1, Arsenal 0. Stanislav Varga made arguably one of the greatest debuts that Sunderland has ever seen. He was magnificent. I think the goalkeeper got sent off for Sunderland and that now Quinn went in goal and he'd scored what was the winner. And we went away thinking, did all right. That Gary Rowell it was his first game as a full match commentator as well. Mick had said, sort of get someone to come in with you because Gatesy had done it before and Gatesy had left in the same summer that Andrew Dolby had. So it was me and Rowell and thought, well, we'd done all right there. Anyway, oh my goodness me. So the letters, thankfully social media wasn't a thing back then, but I can sort of smile about it now. I got a letter saying how bad I was, what a disgrace I was, and that they hoped I died in a car crash on my way home from the next away match.
Oh my God.
Yeah. I know.
Maybe social media did exist.
Yeah, I kept that letter for years.
Yeah.
Just to sort of a reminder how quickly things can change. And then obviously the November of that very first season, just as we were contemplating giving up and Mick doing his best to cajole us and giving us all sorts of advice. And then a certain derby game at St James's changed quite a lot, certainly for me, in terms of the eyes of Sunderland fans, at least anyway.
Well, take us through that.
What do you remember of that day, Mick? Because you were doing the Newcastle commentary.
Yeah. I don't know. I remember it was raining.
Yeah. No, that was the one before.
Oh, was it? Which one are we talking about now?
So the one when it was raining, that was the midweek game, wasn't it? And the rain was biblical.
Was that the one when Shearer had been benched by Hullett?
Yeah, that was the one where Hullett left out Shearer and left out Duncan Ferguson.
Yeah.
And Ferguson beat Shearer to Hullett's office the next morning. So the one you're talking about was...
It was a lovely Saturday, sunny afternoon. Sir Bobby was the manager by this point.
Yeah.
And Kieran Dyer scored really early on for Newcastle.
Sorry, who scored early on for Newcastle?
Kieran Dyer.
Yeah.
And then Don Hutchison equalised.
You're talking about the Sunderland win?
Sunderland win, yes.
Yeah,
and then Niall Quinn scores a header. Shearer has his penalty saved by Thomas Sorensen,
yeah.
In front of the Gallagher.
Yeah.
And at the full-time whistle, we got very giddy and we did the Jorn Nanders, what's his name? The Scandinavian commentator.
Tony Blair.
So yeah. I did a Newcastle version of that. And at the end of it went Anton Deck, Sting, ended on
Jimmy
Tony
Nail.
Blair. Can you hear me, Tony Blair? Your boys are taking on hell of a beating. Ha ha ha. Aren't we jolly funny?
Didn't I get you on Soccer AM?
It did. The very next weekend.
Yeah,
no, I was seeing a girl who lived in Dublin at the time.
Yeah.
So as I was leaving the stadium, Rowell says, we've got to go for a drink in Sunderland tonight. I says, oh, mate, I can't. I said, I've got a flight to catch from Teesside to Dublin. He went, you're not getting it. He said, this might never be a moment like this. We're going into town. So I ditched the flight, went into town. It was a really, really good night. And this is when you could fly to Dublin for like a tenner. And it was genuinely a tenner at the time as well. Got one the next morning, had 2 or 3 days out there and came back to annoyance, shall we say, from
World War III.
Yeah, effectively. Yeah, it did feel like that. But then Sky Sports Soccer AM phoned me up and said, can we use it? And Metro said yes. And we were playing away at Charlton that weekend. So they said, oh, well, come down. Come and sit on the sofa. So it was great. So in the eyes, so having gone, being reminded of Sunderland fans going, who's this idiot with a stupid accent? He knows nothing about Sunderland. Shouldn't be doing the commentary. Not a patch on Dolbers or Guy Gillian Gates or anybody or Charles Harrison from years gone by. Here he is. Who do you think he is? It was a bit of a breakthrough for me. Mm-hmm. And sort of they accepted me from then on. And that was it, really. That was my, if you want to use that expression, sliding doors, I suppose to a certain degree, my Sunderland career or commentary career could have ended much sooner if it wasn't for that.
Well, credit to you then, Mick, because if Simon's getting these horrible letters, then you're getting correspondence too, I assume.
It was writing them.
Yeah.
It'll toughen you up, son.
Yeah.
But you, the boss, of will be mindful and be aware of that reaction. But you persist with people. It's easier in some ways to say, I'll cut you loose, kid.
I must admit, I'll be honest here, I never really got involved in the parochialism of the Tyne Wear divide. I must admit, it isn't something I ever really got involved in. I don't know whether that was a fact that I was of a certain generation or whatever, you know, but Simon is not the only one. I mean, both sides of the border, both sides, black and white and red and white. Some used to take great delight in agitating the others. Where necessary, it's good fun. You know, so when Sunderland have won at St James's Park in the way that they won at St James's Park that day, you know, you can understand it. You know, there were other broadcasters in the Northeast who just used to do it as a means to an end, you know, to get listenership and to curry favour with their particular side of the community, you know. I never really got involved in that. And one of the reasons I never got involved in that dance was because more of my dad's family were from County Durham, and most of them were Sunderland fans anyway. So as a young boy, I remember my dad's dad and three of his brothers stopping off and funnily enough, it was his birthday, the 5th of May, 1973, it was my dad's birthday. And that was the day Sunderland beat Leeds. And they all stopped off in Nottingham on the way down. So I didn't have a soft spot for Sunderland, but obviously because of all my dad's friends. So I never really got involved in that tribalism.
My mum's mum on her side were all Geordies.
Yeah. So it is a very, very tribalistic atmosphere, and it still is nowadays. But going back to what I said earlier about, you know, there's no right and wrong way about commentating, you know, there's no right and wrong way to approach it, you know, whichever it sits comfortably with you, whichever you think, you know, will endear you, then do it. But I must admit, I never got involved in the tribalism. And yet, when I left, the shite I got from Sunderland fans, oh, thank God he's gone. All sorts of nonsense, you know, so I don't know. You can't win either way, really.
No.
I will say, rather than, I didn't feel I was an agitator, it was more because Metro Radio was and is based in the heart of Newcastle. Well, at the time we were on the edge, we were by the Metro Centre, and then moved into that. It felt more like I had to fight five times as hard to get Sunderland in it because it was very, very Newcastle centric.
And that is a really good point, because having worked both sides of the divide in Newcastle, it's even worse at the BBC, because the BBC station that covers Sunderland is called BBC Newcastle. Now, if I was a Sunderland fan, that would have done my tilt for years. And it does do. I mean, they've tried over the years to think about changing the title of the radio station. But for a Sunderland fan to be commentated on by either a station in Newcastle called Metro, which is a little bit bland, but also to be commentated on by a station called BBC Newcastle, I mean, it's going to do your head in, isn't it? It's going
to
do your head in.
We sort of played on that to a certain degree, and in terms of, you know,
yeah.
We did, no, we weren't parochial as such, but I did make a real effort to try and get Sunderland involved, not just in the sport, but in everything in terms of trying to get road shows going out there or presenters going into town and, you know, saying this is a city geographically just as big in terms of population, you know, very similar as well, but very much forgotten about in the one place that it really shouldn't be. So I used to go out of my way to sort of there with my little red and white flag and every opportunity that I did get, it was looking for any sort of equilibrium, really. I felt that to a certain degree as the Sunderland commentator was my job. It maybe wasn't, but that was my thing to try and fight.
And also, first and foremost, and this is why I never got involved in it, and maybe it was down to family history. Believe me, Dance, and I'm more than happy to say this, if at this minute in time Newcastle were where Sunderland are and vice versa, Sunderland would not be able to. They wouldn't be able to find a stadium big enough at the Stadium of Light. You wouldn't get a seat at the Stadium of Light. Mm. If you're talking about big football clubs, they are two huge football clubs. Believe me, they have. You know, they are the epicenter of their community. They are the lifeblood of their two cities. And there is. I know there's almost hatred on occasions, but believe me, there is a huge mutual and grudging respect there between those two communities, because they were both shipbuilders, they were both miners, they were both working class. One played in red and white stripes and one played in black and white stripes, and yes, there's a natural hatred, but believe me, they are monster football clubs, the pair of them. They are monster football clubs, and the world and British football and English football is a worse place without Sunderland in the top flight.
By the way, you talk about BBC Newcastle, you know, being the nom de plume for Sunderland commentaries. Wasn't it right that when ITV had to name the franchise name for the North East, they Tyne Tees is what they settled on, but wasn't it going to be Tyne Wees and Tear? Tyne Weir and Tees. It was supposed to be Tyne Weir and Tees, but then they realised it's spelled TWAT. And so they couldn't go that way, and they had to stick with Tyne Tees.
I've no idea, but I'll tell you what, there's been an awful lot of tears over the years. So maybe tears should have been in there. Maybe it should have been Weir and Tear. No, Tyne and Weir Tears.
Yeah, see, I've stumbled on something there.
Yeah.
Completely by accident. I like that. 25 years as Newcastle United commentator, Mick. If we started talking about specifics within the quarter of a century, we'd be here forever and a day. I met you, you know, in press boxes. We got to know each other fairly well.
Yeah.
One incident I remember very late on in your time with BBC Newcastle was when Rafa had just taken over. And I met you at Leicester. We were doing a game at the King Power. And I think it was Rafa's first game in charge, or maybe his first or his second. Right. And you, me, and somebody else were in that little tiny room where the interview room is at the King Power.
Yeah.
We'd done our interview. We'd all asked our questions. And at the end of the interview, Rafa said, "Okay, mic's off." And we all switched. What did you really... The first thing, he was interested in what we thought about the team he'd inherited. You know, he actually wanted to... I'd never had that before. A manager actually thinking my opinion was worth asking about off the record.
I mean, he's cute. He is cute. But then again, to be fair, I think, you know, at that stage, he was such a fledgling manager at Newcastle. But to be honest, you know, I think I heard... I don't know whether it was Martin Fisher, Fletch, whoever it was on here talking about Clough. And Nottingham, and I actually text Martin Fisher and said, "I can't believe in all the years that you did Forest, you only got Cloughy." And I think he said something ridiculous, like 5 times in 9 years. And I said to him, I said, "I used to get Keegan in a week 5 times. And then I got Hullett, and then I got Sue Ness, and then I got Bobby." Regardless of whether it was Newcastle, and regardless of how successful they were, you know, you were absolutely blessed to be in the company of these people. And I think, you know, once you get into them and once you get a sort of an idea of what makes them tick and you get their trust, it's such a privileged position. It really is. But I think this comes back to the Northeast. They are so aware the local paper, the local radio station, whoever's got the rights, which is another issue, but it's their means to communicate with this huge fan base. I don't think it's the same in any city. I said to somebody the other day, I can remember saying over the years, you know, people used to ring me up and say, I'm a sports editor in Birmingham. I'm a sports editor in Manchester, Liverpool, big cities. You know, we get maybe a big signing every six, you know, this is back in the day. A big signing maybe once a year, a bit of controversy once every 2 years. We used to get it every fortnight. You know, there used to be a big signing, or there'd be Kieran Dyer fighting Lee Bowyer, or there'd be this, that, and the other. But it was all part and parcel of this real melting pot of football. And you know, it could have gone again. It could, you know, when I joined in 1991, it was nothing like that. It was nothing like that. You know, Newcastle were a state, Sunderland were a state. There was no indication that they were going to get anywhere near the heights that they ultimately got. And again, going back to sliding doors, look, call it what you want. My first season, 91-92, Sunderland got to Wembley and played an FA Cup final against Liverpool, and Newcastle sacked Ozzy Ardiles and appointed the Pied Piper, and Keegan arrived. Now, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Somebody up there is seriously, seriously looking down on you, you know?
Yeah, there's highs and lows. I think of Liverpool 4, Newcastle 3 in 96, the famous Collymore closing in game. You'd have been there at Anfield that night, watching Keegan slumping over the advertising hoardings as the title slips away. So the most glorious potential moment in Newcastle's history suddenly slips through their fingers. But it might have gone before that with a defeat against Manchester United at St James's that season. I don't know.
Well, it is. It's too easy. I've always said it's too easy to say that that was the defining moment for me. And I've always said this for as long as I live, I'll say this, that the defining moment was them losing 1-0 at home to Manchester United, when they battered Manchester United. Absolutely. You know, Les Ferdinand, God bless his soul, one of the greatest players that, for a very short period of time, pulled on a black and white shirt, but couldn't hit a barn door with a banjo that night. And Schmeichel's making saves. And then they nick one. And I said it even beforehand, even if they drew that night, I think Manchester United would have said, that's it, game's up. But the fact that they beat Newcastle that night, they could smell the fear. They could smell the fact that they just don't know how to do it. And you need to know how to do it. You need to know how to get over the finishing line. And they went away from St. James's that night, having won 1-0. And you just thought, this is it. And, you know, the 4-3 was part of it. But I think the writing was on the wall prior to that.
So, Simon, let's get back to you, because obviously Sunderland had a...
You don't have to, by the way. I'm quite enjoying listening to Nick's stories.
No. But, you know, it's a double header. You know, otherwise we'd be accused of tying bias over Weir bias, you know, or even tears.
I'm all right with that.
But you had a roller coaster ride watching Sunderland as well. There was, you know, there was Premier League joys, you know, high positions in the top flight. Where did your career change from being a commentator to doing what you do now? For those that don't know, you work for Premier League Productions. You work on match days. You do interviews with managers pre and post and whatnot. Your role has changed in broadcasting from when I knew you in the commentary box.
Yeah, so in terms of, if the question is why you're not doing commentary anymore, because local radio, it's very few and far between where there are any roles like that anyway. Metro... They couldn't monitor exactly how many people, even though we knew a lot of people were still listening, because when the radars came in, you know, and you fill in books, and whereas when we all started, it was very much Saturday, 3 o'clock, and you knew there'd be a spike and it would go off the chart. And that was when people would turn on the radio, and then it would start from 4:45 to sort of go away. You know, phone-ins would keep it going a little bit longer. Mm-hmm. And then that stopped because kickoff times were changing. People were able to watch more games on the television. So from a commercial radio, certainly at local level, they just didn't feel it was viable, rightly or wrongly. For me, wrongly, because we both knew that at the time, you know, irrespective of people can watch it on X, Y, or Z, that there's still, certainly in the Northeast, I would say certainly on Merseyside and some other places as well, you know, there are people who can't afford to subscribe to that sort of channels, or, you know, don't have the means to watch it. But anyway, that's by the by. So eventually local radio, in the, certainly in the Northeast, other than the BBC, stopped doing it. So I moved to Merseyside to be part of Radio City. There, we were setting up a new radio station there that didn't work, sadly. It was a talk, City Talk it was called. And somebody phoned me and said, there's a new thing starting. It's called Premier League Productions. They're looking for reporters. Why don't you give them a call? And in the same way, I was like straight on the phone, had a chat with a guy for the best part of an hour, probably. And he went, right, we'd like to offer you the job. And do you need to see anything? No, it's fine. I'm aware
just,
of
it. Just the smile on my face.
it was brilliant. It was, we didn't meet face to face. I didn't have a show reel. I still don't. And just like with Mick, I'd sat down and had a chat, and then I think they were short of time as well and needed to get someone in quite quickly. 10 years, I mean, I'm self-employed and I've been all that time. So I do other bits and pieces as well, but the majority of it is with them. Maybe that's another sliding doors moment there in terms of someone having the presence of mind to say, have you seen this job? And I hadn't. So there you go.
I did a show reel only once, and that was to get the Talk Sport position that was up for grabs in 2004. Mm. And that was basically just asking my producer to put together just a compilation of my goals on the sly. Mm. Was show reels even a thing that everybody did?
I must admit, and this is how embarrassing it was for me, you know, in terms of the sort of how meteoric this, I don't know what you would call it, rise or whatever was, that having never done a commentary until about 1998, when I left Capital in 91 and went for this job at the BBC as sports editor, I asked the most unbelievable producer stroke tech op stroke whatever, a guy called Pete Simmons, who I think went on to be program controller at all sorts of places in independent radio, but he was the tech op stroke producer of our sports program at Capital. An absolute, the greatest operator I've ever seen in my life. But anyway, we put together a demo tape for the BBC in Newcastle. And I'm not being funny, but the final part of it was my commentary on Daniel Timofte's penalty for Romania against the Republic of Ireland in Genoa in the World Cup. There were other noticeable. And I thought, that's why I need to get out, because they must be playing this thinking, this is ridiculous. I mean, this is like the dog and duck getting a tape saying, this fella thinks he can sing on Saturday, and it was Sinatra, you know. I mean, I'm not blowing, but, you know, I remember I got the call the next day after the interview, and this very, very straight-faced woman at the BBC in Newcastle went, you won't be at all surprised, but you've got the job. And I went, okay, sorry, I'm sorry. I just need a job. You know, you're not trying to be clever, but, you know, it was that sort of time. But
do you miss it, Mick?
No. I was going to say I don't. But the story I want to tell, Dance, before we go, and that is for all, and I've mentioned it already, for all the sliding doors, for all the fortune, for all the luck, combined with all the hard work and whatever it takes to get there, the bottom line is somebody has to give you a chance, which is why we're sat here, and I'm sat here with a young man who I gave a chance to, and I speak every day to people who gave me a chance, etc., etc. In about the year 2000, I think it was, the BBC launched a literacy campaign. And it was one of these box-ticking episodes with the BBC. But a girl at the BBC came to me in Newcastle and said, Mick, would you go into the Young Offenders Institute at Castington, which was next to Castington Prison in Northumberland, and talked to the young offenders in there about sports commentary. And I said, I'd love to. I came from a family of carers. My old man was in social services. My mother was in preschool playgroups. My sister to this day works with autistic children. My other sister works in the NHS. So, you know, we have somewhere in my DNA is a caring bone, not that you'd know it, from days in press boxes up and down the country. So she said, will you go into Castington? So I said, I'll go into Castington. And you went through 20 doors. They took your phones off you. You were locked in. Then you were locked out. Then you were locked in. And eventually I'm in this sports hall with these kids who come in, maybe about 15, 16 of them from varying ages, 11 through to 16, all looking at me as if I'm, who's this guy? So I talk to them about football commentary. After an hour, they get led out. And I say to the teachers and the spotters, because there was a spotter in each corner of the gym, I said, I'm sorry about that. I didn't manage to sort of get them involved. She said, Nick, that's the best they've ever been. She said, normally, after about 5 minutes, they're kicking off, they're fighting. We have to abandon the class, the lot. But what I'd done is, before I left, I said, I want you to go away and write me a match report or record a match report. So I said, this will be interesting. So I went back a week later, again, through the clankety doors. I mean, it was like the opening scenes of Porridge. You know, the doors are clanking and the phones, take your phone off you. The boys come in and they wouldn't tell me what they were in Castington Young Offenders for. And they came and then they put them on my desk, two cassettes and a little pile of reports. And I read them and I swear to God, I was nearly in tears. And I played the report, played the little tape. And again, I was just gone. And I said to them, I said, absolutely amazing. And I gave first prize to a kid from Teesside and second prize to a kid from Northumberland. For one was written and one was spoken. And I swear to God, the pair of you, they were as good as anything any 13 or 14-year-old could ever have done. And they did it at a week's notice. And they're in a prison, a proper prison, by the way. This isn't Borstal. This is proper prison. Anyway, I said to them, so I left my number and they never got back to me. But the point is that we can talk about people giving chances, but are you really given a chance? They should have been given a chance. And I said to them, there's my number. I never heard a word from them. Of course, I didn't hear a word from them because they were in a Young Offenders Institute, but they were as good as any, and I can name you people who were on Match of the Day now who were no better or no worse than one of these kids in the room. And when I left, they said there were four murderers in there. There were bad lads. And I sent the Middlesbrough kid, I got dear old Alistair Brownlee and Gordon Cox on Teesside. They got me a signed Middlesbrough football and I got a load of kit from Ray Thompson at Newcastle and sent it up to the boy who got second. But I never heard another word from them, Dan. And honestly, that's the difference between really getting a chance and not getting a chance.
It's really sobering stuff, actually. I mean, I've done something fairly similar. I went to an open prison in Redditch to give a talk to offenders, but these were much older men.
Yeah,
you were speaking to teenagers. I was speaking to older men. And it was probably more difficult for me in the sense that they had already given up on life, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
Whereas I think the teenagers, probably given up on life probably isn't quite as appropriate a phrase. But I really felt they were attentive, don't get me wrong. And they listened and they participated. But I think they felt they were just going through the motions, doing another thing just to keep them occupied for a day rather than, but although obviously nothing came of it from your perspective,
yeah.
You know, it's just, it's really saddening and it's demoralizing in a way because you come away from there and you do realize how lucky you are, but you also.
I was just about to say the one thing that you should take out of it more than anything else, more than the fact that they missed out on an opportunity or isn't the system wrong in that they didn't get the opportunity. Mm. It's that how lucky are we? Lucky are we that we got that opportunity? And I was 100% genuine when I said earlier, we wouldn't have been in the position we're in and we wouldn't have got into the position we were in unless we worked hard. But they never had the opportunity to do that and prove that.
That's right. That's right. Simon, obviously Mick has retired from commentary. Do you miss commentary? Is there an opportunity? Do you get the opportunity to revisit it now and again? I presume you must do somewhere.
Very rarely. If North End are ever desperate, or if I haven't been asked for Sunderland for a while. Sunderland went through a spell of getting me to do bits and bobs in a place called ADI, which I think...
Oh, in Preston?
Yeah, just geographically it was near me, so I was probably just the easiest option as much as anything.
I went there once to that building. It was like the Marie Celeste. There was nobody in there. It was just me and a monitor screen. I think I was doing something to Everton TV, but there was nobody in there. This mad, like, Jodrell Bank full of processors and all sorts. I was just the only sod in there. Bizarre. Yeah,
they did tell me they knew you were coming, so they all cleared out on that particular day. I think that was what had happened there. But I love the job that I do now. I miss the camaraderie that I think we all had as commentators. You know, when you'd get to a ground and your ISDN line wouldn't be working, or you needed X, Y, or Z, or did you know something about him or whoever it might be. And I did find, in our gang at least, anyway, when we used to do it, I can't think of many, if any, certainly I can't think of any local reporters, commentators who wouldn't do something for one of the others. One or two of the national ones who I won't name that you'd go, maybe not. Mick, the chuckle there from Mick probably suggests that he's
a latter of recognition.
So we don't need to name them. But I do miss that sort of camaraderie in terms of what we were, because we all knew if your line wasn't working this week, it could be their line next week or whatever it was. So you always knew that sooner or later, you were going to need them. And even if you didn't, there was always good value to be had, you know, in terms of having great conversations or learning little tidbits of knowledge or whatever it might be. I do miss that camaraderie side of things. Definitely.
I mean, I hate to say it, but I think, you know, Crabbers has made completely the right. And again, Andrew James, who I was with, you know, last Friday, who was, a great, great help to me. And was a very, very good reporter back in the day. But times move on. You know, I'm not too sure the days of radio commentary aren't pretty much obsolete. I think they certainly are at local level. Maybe at national level, TalkSport and Radio 5 can still provide a service, because basically you're talking about people in cars. You know, that this is what radio commentary always used to be, essentially, people in cars. But I think if you think people are sitting at home waiting for 2 o'clock on a Saturday to listen to Simon Crabtree, Mick Lowes, whoever, I think those days have gone. I think those days have gone because you're on the internet, you're on Sky Soccer Saturday, you're on this, that and the other. So, you know, I hate to say it, but I think times have moved on, and I think maybe there isn't that appetite at a local level that there once was. And that's why, of course, the independent radio stations have pulled the plug, because it just isn't financially worth the commitment and worth the investment that they were going to make. The BBC, you know, let's not get into what the license fee buys you and what the license fee doesn't buy you, but they're in a very privileged position to be able to carry on and continue doing it.
That's maybe the modern day fanzine has found an opportunity, whereas we would buy,
yeah,
whatever, TWR or Sex and Chocolate or whatever your local fanzine might have been. Today's local fanzine, as much as ALS at Sunderland still goes and is still absolutely brilliant,
yeah,
it's YouTubers now, it's podcasts, it's like that we're listening to now. Yeah. And you said at the very start, Mick, you know, in terms of people going, oh, there's no opportunities, more than ever.
Oh,
and people on YouTube are arguably far more successful. As well,
that's why they end up on I'm a Celebrity.
I mean, I really don't get this about some of the people and people I respect, but I've listened to a few of these episodes and they say, oh, woe is the modern day aspirant who wants to get into sports journalism. Jesus, you just put an iPhone on a pod on like I have here on a stand. And if you're good enough and you can broadcast to enough people, you'll get a gig. You're not sitting at home in Nottingham praying that somebody gives you a gig or somebody gives you an opportunity. you know, it's there for you to take. It was never there for us to take.
I think, in fairness, Gary Taphouse, a couple of episodes back, who works for Sky Sports, regularly posts job opportunities every day on his Twitter feed. And that does prove your point, Mick, that all right, it's not all broadcast journalism opportunities.
But it's more than that. It's not even that. I think you don't need a job opportunity anymore.
No.
Like Mick said, you can pick up your phone or your webcam or whatever it might be, connect it to anything or nothing, and then before you know it, Jed's a millionaire.
There's a guy I know called Benjamin Bloom, who's a musician who I've got to know, who started doing a championship EFL blog. He's there in his room. He's got his piano behind him and a couple of guitars. But the knowledge and the enthusiasm...
Absolutely.
And the quality of the delivery, it's all there.
Well, even music's different, isn't it, now, in terms of how we get music. Everything's different. We're not dinosaurs. We understand that things are changing and trying to embrace that to a certain degree in terms of, I love when Mick puts his Instagram pictures on and it sort of takes me to a different place and have a nice little smile, you know, when you put team sheets on or whether you go out and you're doing talking still or doing interviews still. I would subscribe to a podcast with Mick Lowe's in it all day long.
Yeah.
All day long. And we all know enough people, but kids are doing that now and taking the bull by the horns, and they're looking for different ways of doing things, and it's exciting, and they can edit it like we could never even dream of when we had the razor blade and the bit of sticky tape doing stuff together. It's brilliant what you can do. There's loads of stuff out there, and they're making money, and that's brilliant as well. For me, it's really exciting.
Well, Mick mentioned Soccer Saturday earlier, which, you know, became a very, you know, unique way of putting football across on a Saturday afternoon. And out of that has come the watch along, hasn't it? You know, where you're watching somebody watching a game with, I mean, Mark Goldbridge is the classic example of just the Manchester United watch alongs, but he's got these gorgeous graphics all around him. Yes, he's watching the game, and yes, it's quite funny if, you know, United are losing because he'll go into a meltdown. But the production values are actually, they're quite impressive now, aren't they? It's not just, as you say, you can mix, set a iPhone up in your bedroom, but people are really thinking about the look, the visual side of this now, just as much
bottles
as
of beer with Frank Sidebottom's face on it, stuff like that.
He's got an artisan beer just next to his bookshelf, Crabbers, with a picture of dear old Frank Sidebottom on the front that he's got
next to Bob Stoko as well, look.
Oh, Bob Stoko. Oh, well. See, that Sunderland Cup final was the first Cup final I remember as a lad. My older brother, Phil, decided he was a glory-hunting Leeds fan. So me, the irritating little four-year-old brother, decided he'd be a Sunderland fan for that day in 73. So you can imagine what a little git I was for the next few hours when Porterfield did the business and Jim Montgomery made the save of the century.
Not that I've got a room full of beer, by the way, because just for the record, because there's a pub just round the corner that coincidentally the landlord is a massive Sunderland fan.
Oh my God.
Here comes the plug.
I can't just say the taps in Lytham, Mick. That would be senseless. But you will have to come down and they will look after you right royally. But do you remember the Pooninator? I did a commentary at Derby County. And Mark Poom scored a last-minute headed equaliser. In fact, JP used it on Five Live the next night as well, very kindly of him. And they made, the people at this brewery made an ale and stuff. And it's stuff like that. I love all the different ideas that people come up with. And it has gone a lot. I've got all the rejection letters somewhere from all the jobs that I applied for, even work experience I applied for. But again, going back to what Mick said, you know, you kept going, you kept applying for stuff and you kept trying to look for something until eventually they just gave up saying no and said, right, come in there. But now it does feel different that if people do say no, well, you make them pay attention by making a podcast like yours or the YouTubes and Snapchats, and there's so many different, and there'll be new ones in the next 5 or 10 years that we haven't heard yet that will take it to another level again. It's brilliant.
Just before we wrap up, just indulge me for a moment, Mick. Somebody told me a story about Sir Bobby Robson about a book signing in Newcastle.
Oh yeah.
Is this true? That for those who don't know, that there's a story that Bobby was signing books all day, a long queue at Waterstones or wherever it was. Some bloke comes up to him towards the end of the day, hands him a book. Bobby, it's a pleasure to meet you. God, how many books have you signed? Oh, hundreds. And Bobby signs the book, hands it back to him. The bloke goes home, opens up the book, and it says, kind regards, Bobby Hundreds. Is that true, or have you heard that story?
I'll tell you why that is 100% categorically true, because the guy went into Newcastle the following day to the Evening Chronicle's offices in Newcastle and showed them the book. There is an edition of the Evening Chronicle that night, or the following day, obviously, saying Bobby Hundreds. So there's actually a picture of the book that went out in the evening paper. Again, this is going back to the appetite for football. Yeah. Bobby Hundreds is a absolute 100% certain true story. Yeah.
Gorgeous. That's a lovely way to wrap it up, talking about one of the great men of football who... It was a privilege, I'm sure, Mick, for you to speak to, and I'm sure Crabbers, you'd have had dealings with.
He even got my name right as well, so that was a bonus. That was a bonus.
I met Sir Bobby in 1986. As me and my sister and the dog, we were walking up in the Lake District, and he came past the other way, and couldn't do enough in terms of, you want a photograph, son, you want a photograph. Well, he didn't say, do you want a photograph? I obviously asked him, and he more than obliged. Then he gave his wife the camera to take a picture as well. And then when I've met him subsequently since, just what a guy, what a manager, what a genius of a man. Lovely, lovely man.
Absolutely. 100%.
Mick, Simon, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the Commentator's Curse this week. I've learned so much about the Northeast and forget about sliding doors moments. I'm going to try and take that out of the lexicon.
We need to get rid of sliding doors.
Yeah, it's a decent movie, but it's not a particularly useful epithet. Yeah.
Paltrow, though.
Oh, well, absolutely. The lad Paltrow done well.
Yeah. Thanks for inviting us, Dents, though. I mean, it's been lovely for me chatting with him and listening to some of the stories that I've never heard of from Mick as well. And I had so many good years, and Mick treated me so well, looked after me. I can't speak too highly of him. Just honestly, one of the greatest people who I've met, both professionally and personally, became a really good friend in my time at Metro, and I'll never forget that.
Are we going to turn this into a loving? Are we?
I'm just waiting for Eamon Andrews to come walking through the door now with the big red book.
I once did that. I'll tell you very quickly. Yeah. I was going back to the student in London. We were in a student house in North London, and through the door one day dropped this invitation. We opened it up, four invitations to This Is Your Life at a theatre in central London. God knows how these invitations, how they ever got to this house. They must have randomly picked addresses in London. So in Palmer's, I'm going to keep this very quick, Palmer's Green, North London, me and a load of students in 1980.
Right.
So we had them on the windowsill, and it was like, are we going to go to this thing on Saturday? Are we going to go on Tuesday? Are we going to go on Wednesday? Well, it could be Bobby Moore. It could be Bestie. It could be Steve McQueen. It could be whoever. So he said, at the end, it's today. What are we going to do? We're going to go. We got the bus from Wood Green into central London. We got to this theatre. They get you in there. They get you in the green room. They give you a drink, and then they shut the curtains and you can't get out. And we go, it's Bestie. It's Steve McQueen. It's Michael Caine. Fucking Judith Chalmers. And they lock the door behind you, and you can't get out. So we had to sit there. Now, hang on, there's a follow-up. I then went home at Christmas, and I'm in my mum and dad's house, and I'm upstairs getting ready to go down the pub, and I hear, da, 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 and I can overhear them saying, and tonight we're going to surprise one of the greatest television commentators in the world. Blah, blah, it's Judith Chalmers. I get on the phone to my mate. I said, you know, we're in the pub later. You know, when I see you in the test match, watch This Is Your Life, because I'll bet you they wheel on her mother at the end of the program. He went, what? I said, just watch it. they'll wheel her mother on in a wheelchair. I get down the pub an hour later. How did you know that they wheeled on? I said, I was in the audience. But anyway, going back to what I said, I can't leave him saying good things. The nicest guy, the loveliest guy, talented. I sometimes, when I see him behind Klopp at Anfield, I sometimes think he should be doing more than that. He's a born entertainer, a born broadcaster. But we've all had our moment in the sun.
I echo all of that for both of you. You are missed, Mick. I hope that goes without saying, I would hope. Yeah. But you are missed. And Crabbers, it's always great to see you. Like I saw you at Anfield on Saturday Touchline when we were waiting for Jürgen to emerge for his post-match duties. And I hope it's not too long before I see you again somewhere, fella.
Thanks, both.
So my thanks to Simon Crabtree and Mick Lowes for joining me on this episode of The Commentator's Curse. Fantastic listening, I hope you agree. We'll be back again for a very special edition of The Commentator's Curse next week. I can't say too much, but I've got one guest who's joining me for an interview, and it's a true legend of football commentary. You can join me for that next time on The Commentator's Curse. But thanks for your time and joining me for this week's. And don't forget the archives there where you found this podcast for all previous episodes that you can enjoy of The Commentator's Curse.